That would be...
Garion's face contorted in an effort to make the complex calculation in his head. 15 imperials, Silk supplied, or 3 gold crowns.
Gold?
Garion asked. Because gold coins were so rare in country dealings, the words seemed to have an almost magic quality. Silk nodded. It's always preferable. Easier to carry. The weight of silver becomes burdensome.
And how much did we pay for the turnips?
5 imperials, Silk said.
The farmer gets 5, we get 15, and the merchant gets 30?
Garion asked incredulously.
Well, that hardly seems fair.
Silk shrugged. It's the way things are. There's the merchant's house. He pointed at a rather imposing building with broad steps. When we go in, he will pretend to be very busy and not at all interested in us. Later, while he and I are bargaining, he'll notice you and tell you what a splendid boy you are.
Me?
Oh, he'll think that you're some relation of mine, a son or nephew, perhaps, and he will think to gain advantage over me by flattering you.
What a strange notion.
I'll tell him many things, Silk went on, talking very rapidly now, his eyes seeming to glitter and his nose was actually twitching. Pay no attention to what I say, and don't let any surprise show on your face. He'll be watching us both very closely.
You're going to lie?
Oh, it's expected. Oh, he will lie, too. The one of us who lies the best will get the better of the bargain.
It all seems terribly involved.
Oh, it's a game, Silk said, his ferret-like face breaking into a grin. A very exciting game that's played all over the world. Good players get rich and bad players don't.
Are you a good player?
Oh, I'm one of the best, Silk replied modestly. Let's go in. And he led Garion up the broad steps to the merchant's house. The merchant wore an unbelted, fur-trimmed gown of a pale green color and a close-fitting cap. He behaved much as Silk had predicted, sitting before a plain table and leafing through many scraps of parchment with a busy frown on his face while Silk and Garion waited for him to notice them.
"Very well, then," he said finally. "You have business with me."
"We have some turnips," Silk said somewhat deprecatingly.
"That's truly unfortunate, friend,"
the merchant said, assuming a long face.
"The wharves at Kotu groan with turnips just now. It'd hardly pay me to take them off your hands at any price."
Silk shrugged. "Perhaps the Kereks or the Algas, then. Their markets may not yet be as glutted as yours." He turned. "Come along, boy," he said to Garion.
"A moment, good friend. I detect from your speech that you and I are countrymen. Perhaps as a favor, I'll take a look at your turnips."
"Your time's valuable," Silk said. "If you aren't in the market for turnips, why should we trouble you further?"
"I might still be able to find a buyer somewhere," the merchant protested. "If the merchandise is of good quality."
He took the bag from Garion and opened it. Garion listened with fascination as Silk and the merchant fenced politely with each other, each attempting to gain the advantage.
"What a splendid boy this is,"
the merchant said, suddenly seeming to notice Garion for the first time. "An orphan, placed in my care. I'm attempting to teach him the rudiments of business, but he's slow to learn."
"Oh,"
the merchant said, sounding slightly disappointed. Then Silk made a curious gesture with the fingers of his right hand. The merchant's eyes widened slightly, then he too gestured. After that, Garion had no idea of what was going on. The hands of Silk and the merchant wove intricate designs in the air, sometimes flickering so rapidly that the eye could scarce follow them. Silk's long, slender fingers seemed to dance, and the merchant's eyes were fixed upon them, his forehead breaking into a sweat at the intensity of his concentration.
"Done, then?"
Silk said finally, breaking the long silence in the room.
"Done,"
the merchant agreed somewhat ruefully. "It's always a pleasure doing business with an honest man."
"I've learned much today,"
the the merchant said.
I hope you don't intend to remain in this business for long, friend. If you do, I might just as well give you keys to my warehouse and my strong room right now and save myself the anguish that I would experience every time you appear.
Silk laughed. You have been a worthy opponent, friend merchant.
I thought so at first, the merchant said, shaking his head. But I'm no match for you. Deliver your turnips to my warehouse on Bedeck Wharf tomorrow morning.
He scratched a few lines on a piece of parchment with a quill.
My overseer will pay you.
Silk bowed and took the parchment. Come along, boy, he said to Geryon, and led the way from the room.
What happened?
Geryon asked, when they were outside in the blustery street.
We got the price I wanted, Silk said somewhat smugly.
But you didn't say anything.
Oh, we spoke at great length, Geryon. Weren't you watching?
All I saw was the two of you wiggling your fingers at each other.
That's how we spoke. It's a separate language my countrymen devised thousands of years ago. It's called the secret language, and it's much faster than the spoken one. It also permits us to speak in the presence of strangers without being overheard. An adept can conduct business while discussing the weather, if he chooses.
Will you teach it to me?
Geryon asked, fascinated.
It takes a long time to learn.
Well, isn't the trip to Muras likely to take a long time?
Silk shrugged. As you wish. It won't be easy, but it will help to pass the time, I suppose.
Are we going back to the inn now?
Not right away. We'll need a cargo to explain our entry into Muros.
I thought we were going to leave with the wagons empty.
We are.
But you just said,
we'll see a merchant that I know. He buys farm goods all over Sindaria and has them held on the farms until the markets are right in Orindia and Tonedra. And then he arranges to have them freighted either to Muros or Kamar.
It sounds very complicated, Geryon said doubtfully.
It's not really. Silk assured him. Come along, my boy. You'll see.
The merchant was a Tonedran, who wore a flowing blue robe and a disdainful expression on his face. He was talking with a grim-faced Murgle as Silk and Geryon entered his counting room. The Murgle, like all of his race Geryon had ever seen, had deep scars on his face and his black eyes were penetrating. Silk touched Geryon's shoulder with a cautionary hand when they entered and saw the Murgle. Then he stepped forward.
"Forgive me, noble merchant," he said ingratiatingly. "I didn't know you were occupied. My porter and I will wait outside until you have time for us."
"My friend and I will be busy for most of the day," the Tonedran said. "Is it something important?"
"I was just wondering if you might have a cargo for me?" Silk replied.
"No," the Tolnedrin said shortly. "Nothing."
He started to turn back to the Murgo, then stopped and looked sharply at Silk.
"Aren't you Ambar of Kartu? I thought you dealt in spices."
Geryon recognized the name Silk had given the watchman at the gates of the city. It was evident that the little man had used the name before.
"Alas," Silk sighed. "My last venture lies at the bottom of the sea, just off the hook of Orindia. Two full shiploads bound for Tolhanath, a sudden storm, and I'm a pauper."
"A tragic tale worthy, Ambar," the Tonedran master merchant said somewhat smugly.
"I'm now reduced to freighting produce," Silk said morosely. "I have three rickety wagons, and that's all that's left of the Empire of Ambar of Kartu."
"Reverses come to us all," the Tolnedrin said philosophically. "So, this is the famous Ambar of Kartu,"
the Murgo said, his harshly accented voice quite soft. He looked Silk up and down, his black eyes probing.
"It was a fortunate chance that brought me out today. I am enriched by meeting so illustrious a man."
Silk bowed politely.
You're too kind, noble sir.
I am Asharak of Rakoska.
The Murgo introduced himself. He turned toward the Tonedrin.
We can put aside our discussions for a bit, Mingan. We will accrue much honor by assisting so great a merchant to begin recouping his losses.
Oh, you're too kind, worthy Asharak, Silk said, bowing again. Garion's mind was shrieking all kinds of warnings, but the Murgo's sharp eyes made it impossible for him to make the slightest gesture to Silk. He kept his face impassive and his eyes dull, even as his thoughts raced.
I gladly help you, my friend, but I have no cargo in Darin at the moment.
I'm already committed from Darin to Medallia, Silk said quickly. 3 wagon loads of Terek iron. And I also have a contract to move furs from Muros to Kamar. It's the 50 leagues from Medallia to Muros that concerns me. Wagons traveling empty earn no profit.
Medallia, Mingan frowned. Let me examine my reckons. It seems to me that I do have something there.
He stepped out of the room.
Your exploits are legendary. In the kingdoms of the east, Ambar,
Asharak of Rakoska said admiringly.
When last I left Ktholmurgos, there was still a kingly price on your head.
Silk laughed easily.
A minor misunderstanding, Asharak. I was merely investigating the extent of Tonedran intelligence-gathering activities in your kingdom. I took some chances I probably should not have, and the Tonedrans found out what I was up to. The charges they leveled at me were fabrications.
How did you manage to escape? He asked.
The soldiers of King Tar Urgas nearly dismantled the kingdom searching for you.
I chanced to meet a Tulish lady of a high station, Silk said. I managed to prevail upon her to smuggle me across the border into Mishrak Akhtul.
Ah,
Ashrak said, smiling briefly.
Tulish ladies are notoriously easy to prevail upon.
Oh, but most demanding. They expect full repayment for any favors, Silk said. I found it more difficult to escape from her than I did from Ktholmurgos.
Do you still perform such services for your government?
Asharak asked casually.
They won't even talk to me, Silk said with a gloomy expression. Ambar the spice merchant is useful to them, but Ambar the poor wagoneer is quite another thing.
Of course,
Asharak said, and his tone indicated that he obviously did not believe what he had been told. He glanced briefly, and without seeming interest, at Garion, and Garion felt a strange shock of recognition. Without knowing exactly how it was that he knew, he was instantly sure that Asharak of Rakoska had known him for all of his life. There was a familiarity in that glance, a familiarity that had grown out of the dozen times or more that their eyes had met while Garion was growing up, and Asharak, muffled always in a black cloak and astride a black horse, had stopped and watched, and then moved on. Garion returned the gaze without expression, and the faintest hint of a smile flickered across Asharak's scarred face.
Mingan returned to the room then.
We have some hams on a farm near Medallia. When do you expect to arrive in Muros?
15, 20 days.
Mingan nodded. I'll give you a contract to move my hams to Muros. 7 silver nobles per wagon load.
A Tunedran nobles or Sindarian?
Silk asked quickly.
This is Sindaria, worthy Ambar.
And we are citizens of the world, noble merchant. Transactions between us have always been in Tonedrin coin.
Mingan sighed.
You were ever quick, worthy Ambar. Very well, Tonedrin nobles, because we are old friends, and I grieve for your misfortunes.
Perhaps we will meet again, Ambar, Asharak said.
Perhaps, Silk said, and he and Geryon left the counting room.
Skinflint, Silk muttered when they reached the street. Rate should have been 10, not 7.
What about the Murgle? Geryon asked.
Once again there was the familiar reluctance to reveal too much about the strange, unspoken link that had existed between him and the figure that now at least had a name. Silk shrugged.
He knows I'm up to something, but he doesn't know exactly what. Just as I know that he is up to something. I've had dozens of meetings like that. Unless our purposes happen to collide, we won't interfere with each other. Ashrak and I are both professionals.
You're a very strange person, Silk. Silk winked at Geryon.
Why were you and Mengen arguing about the coins?
Tonedrin coins are a bit purer. They are worth more.
I see, said Geryon.
The next morning they all mounted the wagons again and delivered their turnips to the warehouse of the Drasnian merchant. Then, their wagons rumbling emptily, they rolled out of Derin, bound toward the south. The rain had ceased, but the morning was overcast and blustery. On the hill outside town, Silk turned to Geryon, who rode beside him.
Very well. Let's begin.
He moved his fingers in front of Garion's face.
This means good morning.
Chapter 8. After the first day, the wind blew itself out, and the pale autumn sun reappeared. Their route southward led them along the Darin River, a turbulent stream that rushed down from the mountains on its way to the Gulf of Cherek. The country was hilly and timbered, but since the wagons were empty, their horses made good time. Geryon paid scant attention to the scenery as they trundled up the valley of the Darin. His attention was riveted almost totally on Silk's flickering fingers.
"Don't shout," Silk instructed, as Geryon practiced.
"Shout?" Geryon asked, puzzled. "Keep the gestures small. Don't exaggerate them. The idea is to make the whole business inconspicuous."
"I'm only practicing. Better to break bad habits before they become too strong. And be careful not to mumble."
"Mumble?"
"Form each phrase precisely. Finish one before you go on to the next. Don't worry about speed. That comes with time."
By the third day, their conversations were half in words and half in gestures, and Geryon was beginning to feel quite proud of himself. They pulled off the road into a grove of tall cedars that evening and formed up their usual half-circle with the wagons.
"How goes the instruction?"
Mr. Wolf asked as he climbed down.
"It progresses. I expect it will go more rapidly when the boy outgrows his tendency to use baby talk."
Geryon was crushed. Barak, who was also dismounting, laughed.
"I have often thought that the secret language might be useful to know," he said. "But fingers built to grip a sword are not nimble enough for it."
He held out his huge hand and shook his head. Durnek lifted his face and sniffed at the air.
"It's going to be cold tonight.
We'll have frost before morning."
Barak also sniffed and then nodded.
"You're right, Durnek. We'll need a good fire tonight."
He reached into the wagon and lifted out his axe.
"There are riders coming," Aunt Paul announced, still seated on the wagon.
They all stopped talking and listened to the faint drumming sound on the road that they had just left.
"Three at least,"
Barak said grimly. He handed the axe to Durnek and reached back into the wagon for his sword.
"Four,"
Silk said. He stepped to his own wagon and took his own sword out from under the seat.
"We are far enough from the road,"
the wolf said.
"If we stay still, they will pass without seeing us."
"They won't hide us from Grollums," Aunt Paul said. "They won't be searching with their eyes."
She made two quick gestures to Wolf, which Geryon did not recognize.
"No," Wolf gestured back. "Let us instead..."
He also made an unrecognizable gesture. Aunt Paul looked at him for a moment and then nodded.
All of you, stay quite still, the wolf instructed them.
When he turned toward the road, his face was intent.
Geryon held his breath. The sound of the galloping horses grew nearer.
Then a strange thing happened. Though Geryon knew he should be fearful of the approaching riders and the threat they seemed to pose, a kind of dreamy lassitude fell over him. It was as if his mind had quite suddenly gone to sleep, leaving his body still standing there, watching incuriously the passage of those dark-mantled horsemen along the road. How long he stood so, he was not able to say. But when he roused from his half-dream, the riders were gone, and the sun had set. The sky to the east had grown purple with approaching evening, and there were tatters of sun-stained clouds along the western horizon.
Murgos, Aunt Paul said quite calmly. And one Grolem.
She started to climb down from the wagon.
There are many Murgos in Sindaria, great lady, Silk said, helping her down. And on many different missions.
Murgos are one thing, the wolf said grimly. But Grolems are quite something else. I think it might be better if we moved off these well-traveled roads. Do you know a back way to Medelia?
Old friend, Silk replied modestly, I know a back way to every place.
Good. Let's move deeper into these woods. I'd prefer it if no chance gleam from our fire reached the road.
Geryon had seen the cloaked Murgos only briefly. There was no way to be sure if one of them had been that same Asherak he had finally met after all the years of knowing him only as a dark figure on a black horse. But somehow, he was almost certain that Asherak had been among them. Asherak would follow him, would be there wherever he went. It was the kind of thing one could count on. Durnik had been right when he had spoken of frost. The ground was white with it the next morning, and the horses' breath steamed in the chill air as they set out. They moved along lanes and little-used tracks that were partially weed-choked. The going was slower than it might have been on the main road, but they all felt much safer. It took them 5 more days to reach the village of Winold, some 12 leagues to the north of Medelia. There, at Aunt Paul's insistence, they stopped overnight at a somewhat run-down inn.
I refuse to sleep on the ground again, she announced flatly.
After they had eaten in the dingy common room of the inn, the men turned to their ale pots, and Aunt Paul went up to her chamber with instructions that hot water be brought to her for bathing. Geryon, however, made some pretext about checking the horses and went outside. It was not that he was in the habit of being deliberately deceptive, but it had occurred to him in the last day or so that he had not had a single moment alone since they had left Faldor's farm. He was not by nature a solitary boy, but he had begun to feel quite keenly the restriction of always being in the presence of his elders. The village of Winold was not a large one, and he explored it from one end to the other, in less than half an hour, loitering along its narrow cobblestone streets in the crispness of the early evening air. The windows of the houses glowed with golden candlelight, and Geryon suddenly felt a surge of homesickness. Then, at the next corner of the crooked street in the brief light from the opening of a door, he saw a familiar figure. He could not be positive, but he shrank back against a rough stone wall anyway. The man at the corner turned in irritation toward the light, and Geryon caught the sudden white gleam from one of his eyes. It was Brill. The unkempt man moved quickly out of the light, obviously not wishing to be seen. Then he stopped. Geryon hugged the wall, watching Brill's impatient pacing at the corner. The wisest thing would have been to slip away and hurry back to the inn, but Geryon quickly dismissed the idea. He was safe enough here in the deep shadows beside the wall, and he was too caught up by curiosity to leave without seeing exactly what Brill was doing here. After what seemed hours, but was really only a few more minutes, another shadowy shape came scurrying down the street. The man was hooded, so it was impossible to see his face, but the outline of his form revealed a figure dressed in the tunic, hose, and calf-length boots of an ordinary sindar. There was also, when he turned, the outline of a sword belted at his waist, and that was far from ordinary. While it was not precisely illegal for sindars of the lower classes to bear arms, it was uncommon enough to attract a notice. Geryon tried to edge close enough to hear what Brill said to the man with the sword, but they spoke only briefly. There was a clink as some coins changed hands, and then the two separated. Brill moved quietly off around the corner, and the man with the sword walked up the narrow, crooked street toward the spot where Geryon stood. There was no place to hide, and as soon as the hooded man came close enough, he would be able to see Geryon. To turn and run would have been even more dangerous. Since there was no alternative, Geryon put on a bold front and marched determinedly toward the oncoming figure.
"Who's there?"
the hooded man demanded, his hand going to his sword hilt.
"Good evening, sir,"
Geryon said, deliberately forcing his voice up into the squeaky registers of a much younger boy.
"Cold night, isn't it?"
The hooded man grunted and seemed to relax. Garion's legs quivered with a desire to run. He passed the man with a sword, and his back prickled as he felt that suspicious gaze following him.
"Bye,"
the man said abruptly. Geryon stopped.
"Yes, sir?" "Do you live here?" "Yes, sir,"
Geryon lied, trying to keep his voice from trembling.
"Is there a tavern hereabouts?"
Geryon had just explored the town, and he spoke confidently.
"Yes, sir. You go on up this street to the next corner and turn to your left. There are torches out front. You can't miss it." "My thanks,"
the hooded man said shortly, and walked on up the narrow street.
"Good night, sir,"
Geryon called after him, made bold by the fact that the danger seemed past. The man did not answer, and Geryon marched on down to the corner, exhilarated by his brief encounter. Once he was around the corner, however, he dropped the guise of a simple village boy, and he ran. He was breathless by the time he reached the inn and burst into the smoky common room where Mr. Wolf and the others sat talking by the fire. At the last instant, realizing that to blurt out his news in the common room, where others might overhear, would be a mistake, he forced himself to walk calmly to where his friends sat. He stood in front of the fire as if warming himself, and spoke in a low tone.
"I just saw Brill in the village."
"Brill?" Silk asked. "Who is Brill?" Wolf frowned.
"A farmhand, with too much Angorak gold in his purse to be entirely honest."
Quickly, he told Silk and Barak about the adventure in Faldor's stable.
"You should have killed him,"
Barak rumbled.
"This is not Kerak," Wolf said. "Sindars are touchy about casual killings."
He turned to Geryon.
"Did he see you?"
"No," Geryon said. "I saw him first and hid in the dark. He met another man and gave him some money, I think. The other man had a sword."
Briefly he described the whole incident.
"This changes things. I think we'll leave here earlier in the morning than we had planned." "It wouldn't be hard to make Brill lose interest in us,"
Durnick said.
"I could probably find him and hit him on the head a few times."
"Tempting," the wolf grinned. "But I think it might be better just to slip out of town early tomorrow and leave him with no notion that we've ever been here. We don't really have time to start fighting with everyone that we run across."
"I'd like a closer look at this sword-carrying sender, however," Silk said, rising. "If it turns out that he's following us, I'd rather know what he looks like. I don't like being followed by strangers."
"Discreetly," the wolf cautioned.
Silk laughed. Have you ever known me to be otherwise? Oh, this won't take long. Where did you say that tavern was, Geryon? Geryon gave him directions. Silk nodded, his eyes bright and his long nose twitching. He turned, went quickly across the smoky common room and out into the chill night.
I wonder, Beric considered, if we are being followed this closely. Wouldn't it be better to discard the wagons and this tiresome disguise, buy good horses and simply make straight for Muros at a gallop?
Wolf shook his head.
I don't think. The Murkers are all that certain where we are. Bro could be here for some other dishonesty. And we would be foolish to start running from shadows. It is better just to move on quietly. Even if Brill's still working for the Murkos, I would rather just slip away and leave them all beating the bushes here in Central Sandaria.
He stood up.
I am going to step upstairs and let Paul know what's happened.
He crossed the common room and mounted the stairs.
I still don't like it,
Beric muttered, his face dark. They sat quietly then, waiting for Silk's return. The fire popped and Geryon started slightly. It occurred to him as he waited that he had changed a great deal since they had left Faldor's farm. Everything had seemed simple then, with the world neatly divided into friends and enemies. In the short time since they had left, however, he had begun to perceive complexities that he had not imagined before. He had grown wary and distrustful, and listened more frequently to that interior voice that always advised caution, if not outright guile. He'd also learned not to accept anything at face value. Briefly, he regretted the loss of his former innocence, but the dry voice told him that such regret was childish. Then Mr. Wolf came back down the stairs and rejoined them. After about a half hour, Silk returned. "Thoroughly disreputable-looking fellow," he said, standing in front of the fire. "My guess is that he's a common footpad."
"Brill seeking his natural level," the wolf observed. "If he's still working for the Murkos, he's probably hiring ruffians to watch for us. They'll be looking for four people on foot, however, rather than six in wagons. If we can get out of Winold early enough in the morning, I think we can elude them altogether." "I think Durnik and I should stand watch tonight,"
Beric said.
"Not a bad idea. Let's plan to leave about the fourth hour after midnight. I'd like to have two or three leagues of back roads between us and this place when the sun comes up."
Geryon scarcely slept that night. When he did, there were nightmares about a hooded man with a cruel sword chasing him endlessly down dark, narrow streets. When Beric woke them, Geryon's eyes felt sandy and his head was thick from the exhausting night. Aunt Paul carefully drew the shutters in their chamber before lighting a single candle. "It's going to be colder now," she said, opening the large bundle she had had him carry up from the wagons. She took out a pair of heavy woolen hose and winter boots lined with lamb's wool. "Put these on," she instructed Geryon, "and your heavy cloak." "I'm not a baby anymore, Aunt Paul," Geryon said. "Do you enjoy being cold?" "Well, no, but—" He stopped. Unable to think of any words to explain how he felt, he began to dress. He could hear the faint murmuring of the others talking softly in the adjoining chamber in that curious hushed tone that men always assume when they rise before the sun. "We are ready, Mistress Paul," Silk's voice came through the doorway. "Let's leave, then," she said, drawing up the hood of her cloak. The moon had risen late that night and shone brightly on the frost-silvered stones outside of the inn. Durnik had hitched the horses to the wagons and had led them out of the stable.
"We'll lead the horses out to the road," the wolf said very quietly. "I do not see any need for rousing the villagers as we pass."
Silk again took the lead, and they moved slowly out of the inn yard. The fields beyond the village were white with frost, and the pale, smoky-looking moonlight seemed to have leached all of the color from them.
"As soon as we are well out of earshot," Wolf said, climbing up into his wagon, "let's put some significant distance between us and this place. The wagons are empty, and a little run won't hurt the horses."
"Truly," Silk agreed. They all mounted their wagons and set off at a walk. The stars glittered overhead in the crisp, cold sky. The fields were very white in the moonlight, and the clumps of trees back from the road were very dark. Just as they went over the first hilltop, Geryon looked back at the dark cluster of houses in the valley behind. A single flicker of light came from a window somewhere, a lone golden pinpoint that appeared, then vanished.
"Someone's awake back there. I just saw a light," he told Silk.
"Some early riser, perhaps," Silk suggested.
But then again, perhaps not."
He shook the reins slightly, and the horses increased their pace. He shook them again, and they began to trot.
"Hang on, boy," he instructed, reaching forward and slapping the reins down smartly on the rumps of the horses.
The wagon bounced and clattered fearfully behind the running team, and the bitterly chill air rushed at Geryon's face as he clung to the wagon seat. At full gallop, the three wagons plunged down into the next valley, rushing between the frost-white fields and the bright moonlight, leaving the village and its single light far behind. By the time the sun rose, they had covered a good 4 leagues, and Silk reined in his steaming horses. Geryon felt battered and sore from the wild ride over the iron-hard roads, and was glad for the chance to rest. Silk handed him the reins and jumped down from the wagon. He walked back and spoke briefly to Mr. Wolf and Aunt Pol, then returned to the wagon.
"We turn off at that lane just ahead," he told Geryon, as he massaged his fingers.
Geryon offered him the reins.
"You drive. My hands are frozen stiff. Just let the horses walk."
Geryon clucked at the horses and shook the reins slightly. Obediently, the team started out again.
"The lane circles around to the back of that hill," Silk said, pointing with his chin, since his hands were tucked inside his tunic. "On the far side, there's a copse of fir trees. We'll stop there to rest the horses."
"Do you think we're being followed?"
"This will be a good time to find out."
They rounded the hill and drove on down to where the dark firs bordered the road. Then Geryon turned the horses and moved in under the shadowy trees.
"This will do fine," Silk said, getting down.
"Come along."
"Where are we going?"
"I want to have a look at that road behind us," Silk said. "We'll go up the trees to the top of the hill and see if our back trail has attracted any interest."
And he started up the hill, moving quite rapidly but making absolutely no sound as he went. Geryon floundered along behind him, his feet cracking the dead twigs underfoot embarrassingly, until he began to catch the secret of it. Silk nodded approvingly once, but said nothing. The trees ended just at the crest of the hill, and Silk stopped there. The valley below, with a dark road passing through it, was empty except for 2 deer who had come out of the woods on the far side to graze in the frosty grass.
"We'll wait a minute," Silk said. "If Brill and his hireling are following, they should not be far behind."
He sat on a stump and watched the empty valley. After a while, a cart moved slowly along the road toward Winold. It looked tiny in the distance, and its pace along the scar of the road seemed very slow. The sun rose a bit higher, and they squinted into its full morning brightness.
"Silk?"
Geryon said finally in a hesitant tone.
"Yes, Geryon."
"What is this all about?"
It was a bold question to ask, but Geryon felt he knew Silk well enough to ask it.
"All what?" "What we're doing. I've heard a few things and guessed a few more, but it doesn't really make any sense to me."
"And just what have you guessed, Geryon?"
Silk asked, his small eyes very bright in his unshaven face. "Something's been stolen, something very important, and Mr. Wolf and Aunt Paul and the rest of us are trying to get it back."
"All right," Silk said. "That much is true."
"Mr. Wolf and Aunt Paul are not at all what they seem to be," Garion went on.
"No."
"No, they aren't. I think they can do things that other people can't do," Garion said, struggling with his words. "Mr. Wolf can follow this thing, whatever it is, without seeing it. And last week in those woods when the Murgos passed, they did something. I don't even know how to describe it, but it was almost as if they reached out and put my mind to sleep. How did they do that? And why?"
Silk chuckled. "You are a very observant lad."
Then his tone became more serious.
"We're living in a momentous time, Garion. The events of thousands of years and more, all focused on these very days. The world, I'm told, is like that. Centuries pass when nothing happens, and then, in a few short years, events of such tremendous importance take place that the world is never the same again."
"I think that if I had my choice, I'd prefer one of those quiet centuries."
"Oh, no," Silk said, his lips drawing back in a ferret-like grin. "Now's the time to be alive, to see it all happening, to be a part of it. That makes the blood race, and each breath is an adventure."
Garion let that pass. "What is this thing we're following?"
"It is best if you don't even know its name," Silk told him seriously, "or the name of the one who stole it. There are people trying to stop us, and what you don't know, you cannot reveal."
"I'm not in the habit of talking to Murgos," Garion said stiffly.
"It is not necessary to talk to them," Silk told him. "There are some among them who can reach out and pick the thoughts right out of your mind."
"That's not possible."
"Who's to say what's possible and what isn't?" Silk asked him.
And Garion remembered a conversation he had once with Mr. Wolf about the possible and the impossible. Silk sat on the stump in the newly risen sun, looking thoughtfully down into the still, shadowy valley, an ordinary-looking little man in ordinary-looking tunic and hose and a rough brown shoulder cape with its hood turned up over his head.
"You were raised as a Sindar, Garion. And Sindars are solid, practical men with little patience for such things as sorcery and magic and other things that can't be seen or touched. Your friend Ternek is a perfect Sindar. He can mend a shoe or fix a broken wheel or dose a sick horse. But I doubt that he could bring himself to believe in the tiniest bit of magic."
"I am a Sindar," Garion objected. The hint implicit in Silk's observation struck at the very center of his sense of his own identity. Silk turned and looked at him closely.
"No. You aren't. I know a Sindar when I see one, just as I can recognize the difference between an Erend and a Tolnedron, or a Kerek and an Algar. There's a certain set of the head, a certain look about the eyes of Sindars, that you don't have. You are not a Sindar."
"Well, what am I then?" Garion challenged.
"I don't know," Silk said, with a puzzled frown. "And that's very unusual, since I've been trained to know what people are. It may come to me in time, though."
"Is Aunt Paul a Sindar?"
"Of course not," Silk laughed.
"Well, that explains it, then. I'm probably the same thing she is."
Silk looked sharply at him.
"She's my father's sister, after all," Garion said. "At first I thought it was my mother she was related to, but that was wrong. It was my father. I know that now."
"That's impossible," Silk said flatly.
"Impossible?"
"Absolutely out of the question.
The whole notion's unthinkable.
Why?
Silk chewed at his lower lip for a moment. Let's go back to the wagons, he said shortly. They turned and went down through the dark trees with the bright morning sunlight slanting on their backs and the frosty air. They rode the back lanes for the rest of the day. Late in the afternoon, when the sun had begun to drop into a purple bank of clouds toward the west, they arrived at the farm where they were to pick up Mingan's hams. Silk spoke with the stout farmer and showed him the piece of parchment Mingan had given them in Darin.
"I'll be glad to get rid of them," the farmer said. "You've been occupying storage space that I sorely need."
"That's frequently the case when one has dealings with Toledrans," Silk observed. "They are gifted at getting a bit more than they pay for, even if it's only the free use of someone else's storage sheds." The farmer glumly agreed.
"I wonder," Silk said, as if the thought had just occurred to him, "I wonder if you might have seen a friend of mine, Brill, by name? A medium-sized man with black hair and beard and a cast to one eye?"
"Fresh clothes and a sour disposition?" the stout farmer asked.
"Yes, that's him."
"He's been about the area. Looking, or so he said, for an old man and a woman and a boy. Said that they stole some things from his master, and that he'd been sent to find them."
"How long ago was that?"
"A week or so."
"Oh, I'm sorry to have missed him. I wish I had the leisure to look him up."
"I can't think for my life think why," the farmer said bluntly. "To be honest with you, I don't much care for your friend."
"Oh, I'm not over-fond of him myself, but the truth is that he owes me some money. I could quite easily do without Brittle's companionship, but I am lonesome for the money, if you take my meaning."
The farmer laughed.
"I'd take it as a kindness if you happen to forget that I asked after him. He'll likely be hard enough to find, even if he isn't warned that I am looking for him."
"You can depend on my discretion," the stout man said, still laughing. "I'm gotten a loft where you and your wagoneers can put up for night. I'd take it kindly if you'd sup with my workers in the dining hall over there."
"Well, my thanks to you," Silk said, bowing slightly. "The ground's cold. It's been some time since we've eaten anything but the rough fare of the road."
"You wagoneers lead adventuresome lives," the stout man said almost enviously. "Free as birds, always a new horizon just beyond next hilltop."
"It is much overrated," Silk told him. "And winter's a thin time for birds and wagoneers both."
The farmer laughed again, clapping Silk on the shoulder and then showing him where to put up the horses. The food in the stout farmer's dining hall was plain, but there was plenty, and the loft was a bit drafty, but the hay was soft. Geryon slept soundly. The farm was not Faldor's, but it was familiar enough, and there was that comforting sense of having walls about him again that made him feel secure. The following morning, after a solid breakfast, they loaded the wagons with the Tolnedran salt-crusted hams and bade the farmer a friendly goodbye. The clouds that had begun to bank up in the west the evening before had covered the sky during the night, and it was cold and gray as they set out for Muros, 50 leagues to the south. Chapter 9. The almost 2 weeks it took them to reach Muros were the most uncomfortable Geryon had ever spent. Their route skirted the edge of the foothills through rolling and sparsely settled country, and the sky hung gray and cold overhead. There were occasional spits of snow, and the mountains loomed black against the skyline to the east. It seemed to Geryon that he would never be warm again. Despite Durnik's best efforts to find dry firewood each night, their fires always seemed pitifully small, and the great cold around them enormously large. The ground upon which they slept was always frozen, and the chill seemed actually to seep into Geryon's bones. His education in the Drasnian secret language continued, and he became, if not adept, at least competent by the time they passed Lake Kamar and began the long downhill grade that led to Muros.
The city of Muros, in south-central Sindaria, was a sprawling, unattractive place that had been, since time immemorial, the site of a great annual fair. Each year in late summer, Algar horsemen drove vast cattle herds through the mountains along the great north road to Muros, where cattle buyers from all over the west gathered to await their coming. Huge sums changed hands, and because the Algar clansmen also commonly made their yearly purchases of useful and ornamental articles at that time, merchants from as far away as Naissa in the remote south gathered to offer their wares. A large plain which lay to the east of the city was given over entirely to the cattle pens that stretched for miles, but were still inadequate to contain the herds which arrived at the height of the season. Beyond the pens, to the east, lay the more or less permanent encampment of the Algars. It was to this city, when mid-morning, at the tag end of the fair, when the cattle pens were nearly empty and most of the Algars had departed, and only the most desperate merchants remained, that Silk led the three wagons laden with the hams of Mingan the Tonedrin. The delivery of the hams took place without incident, and the wagons soon drew into an inn-yard near the northern outskirts of the city. "This is a respectable inn, great lady," Silk assured Aunt Paul as he helped her down from the wagon. "I have stopped here before."
"Oh, let us hope so," she said. "The inns of Muros have an unsavory reputation."
"Those particular inns lie along the eastern edge of the town," Silk assured her delicately.
I know them well." "I'm certain you do," she said, with an arched eyebrow. "My profession sometimes requires me to seek out places I might otherwise prefer to avoid."
The inn, Geryon noted, was surprisingly clean, and its guests seemed for the most part to be Sindarian merchants.
"I thought there'd be many different kinds of people here in Muros," he said, as he and Silk carried their bundles up to the chambers on the second floor.
"There are," Silk said, "but each group tends to remain aloof from the others. The Tonedrins gather in one part of the town, the Drasnians in another, the Naissans in yet another. The Earl of Muros prefers it that way. Tempers sometimes flare in the heat of the day's business, and it's best not to have natural enemies housed under the same roof." Geryon nodded. "You know," he said, as they entered the chambers they had taken for their stay in Muros, "I don't think I've ever seen a Naissan."
"You're lucky," Silk said with distaste. "They are an unpleasant race." "Are they like the Murgos?"
"No," Silk said. "The Naissans worship Issa, the snake god, and it's considered seemly among them to adopt the mannerisms of the serpent. I don't find it at all attractive myself.
Besides, the Naissans murdered the Raven King, and all Alons have disliked them since then."
"The Ravens don't have a king," Geryon objected.
"Not anymore," Silk said. "They did once, though, until Queen Selmisra decided to have him murdered."
"When was that?"
Geryon asked, fascinated.
1300 years ago," Silk said, as if it had only been yesterday.
"Isn't that sort of a long time to hold a grudge?"
"Some things are unforgivable," Silk said shortly.
Since there was still a good part of the day left, Silk and Wolf left the inn that afternoon to search the streets of Muros for those strange lingering traces that Wolf could apparently see or feel, and which would tell him whether the object they sought had passed this way. Geryon sat near the fire in the chamber he shared with Aunt Paul, trying to bake the chill out of his feet. Aunt Paul also sat by the fire, mending one of his tunics, her shining needle flickering in and out of the fabric.
"Who was the Riven King, Aunt Paul?"
She stopped sewing.
"Why do you ask?" "Silk was telling me about Naissans. He told me that their queen murdered the Riven King. Why would she do that?"
"You are full of questions today, aren't you?"
she asked him, her needle moving again.
Well, Silk and I talk about a lot of things as we ride along,
Geryon said, pushing his feet even closer to the fire.
Don't burn your shoes.
Silk says that I'm not a Sindar. He says that he doesn't know what I am, but that I'm not a Sindar.
Silk talks too much,
Aunt Paul observed.
Well, you never tell me anything, Aunt Paul,
he said in irritation.
I tell you everything that you need to know, she said calmly. Right now it is not necessary for you to know anything about Raven Kings or Niacin Queens.
All you want to do is to keep me an ignorant child,
Geryon said petulantly.
I'm almost a man, and I don't even know what I am, or who.
I know who you are, she said, not looking up.
Well, who am I then?
You are a young man who's about to catch his shoes on fire.
He jerked his feet back quickly.
You didn't answer me.
That's right,
she said in that infuriatingly calm voice.
Well, why not?
It's not necessary for you to know yet. When it is time, I will tell you, but not until.
But that's not fair.
The world's full of injustice. Now, since you are feeling so manly, why don't you fetch some more firewood? That will give you something useful to think about.
He glared at her and stamped across the room.
Geryon, she said.
What?
Don't even think about slamming the door.
That evening, when Wolf and Silk returned, the usually cheerful old man seemed impatient and irritable. He sat down at the table in the common room of the inn and stared moodily at the fire.
I don't think it passed this way, he said finally. There are a few places left to try. But I'm almost certain that it hasn't been here.
Then we go on to Kamar,
Barak rumbled, his thick fingers combing his bristling beard.
We must, Wolf said. Most likely we should have gone there first.
There is no way to know it,
Aunt Paul told him.
Why would he go to Kamar if he's trying to carry it to the Angarak kingdoms?
I can't even be certain where he's going. Maybe he wants to keep the thing for himself. He has always coveted it.
Wolf stared into the fire again.
We're going to need some kind of freight for the trip to Kamar, Silk said.
Wolf shook his head.
It slows us too much. It's not unusual for wagons to return to Kamar from Muros without freight, and it's reaching the point where we'll have to gamble our disguise for the sake of speed. It's 40 leagues to Kamar, and the weather is turning bad. A heavy snowstorm could stop the wagons entirely, and I don't have time to spend the whole winter mired down in a snowbank.
Durnick dropped his knife suddenly and started to scramble to his feet.
What's amiss?
Barak asked quickly.
I just saw Brill, Durnick said. It was in that doorway. Are you sure? I know him, Durnick said grimly. It was Brill, all right.
Silk pounded his fist down on the table.
Idiot,
he accused himself. I underestimated the man.
That doesn't matter now,
Mr. Wolf said, and there was almost a kind of relief in his voice.
Our disguise is useless now. I think it's time for speed.
I'll go see to the wagons, Durnick said.
No, the wagons are too slow. We'll go to the camp of the Algars and buy good horses.
He stood up quickly.
What are the wagons?
Durnick persisted.
Forget them. They're only a hindrance now. We'll ride the wagon horses to the camp of the Algars and take only what we can conveniently carry. Let's get ready to leave immediately. Meet me in the inn yard as soon as you can.
He went quickly to the door and out into the cold night. It was only a few minutes later that they all met near the door to the stable in the cobblestoned inn yard, each carrying a small bundle.
Hulking Barak jingled as he walked, and Geryon could smell the oiled steel of his mail shirt.
A few flakes of snow drifted down through the frosty air, settling like tiny feathers on the frozen ground.
Durnick was the last to join them. He came breathlessly out of the inn and pressed a small handful of coins upon Mr. Wolfe.
"It's the best I could do," he apologized. "Scarce half the worth of the wagons." "But the innkeeper sensed my haste and bargained meanly."
He shrugged then.
"At least we readied them. It's not good to leave things of value behind. They nag at the mind and distract one from the business at hand."
Silk laughed. "Durnick, you are the absolute soul of a cinder."
"One must follow one's nature," Durnick said.
"Thank you, my friend,"
Wolf said gravely, dropping the coins into his purse.
"Let's lead the horses. Galloping through these narrow streets at night would only attract attention."
"I'll lead,"
Beric announced, drawing his sword.
"If there's any trouble, I am best equipped to deal with it."
"I'll walk alongside you, friend Beric,"
Durnick said, hefting a stout cudgel of firewood. Beric nodded, his eyes grimly bright, and led his horse out through the gate with Durnick closely at his side. Taking his lead from Durnick, Geryon paused momentarily as he passed the woodpile and selected a good oak stick. It had a comforting weight, and he swung it a few times to get the feel of it. Then he saw Aunt Paul watching him, and he hurried on without any further display. The streets through which they passed were narrow and dark, and the snow had begun to fall a bit more heavily now, settling almost lazily through the dead, calm air. The horses, made skittish by the snow, seemed to be fearful and crowded close to those who led them. When the attack came, it was unexpected and swift. There was a sudden rush of footsteps and the sharp ring of steel on steel as Beric fended off the first blow with his sword. Geryon could see only the shadowy figures outlined against the falling snow, and then, as once before when in his boyhood he had struck down his friend Runderig in mock battle, his ears began to ring. His blood surged boilingly in his veins as he leaped into the fight, ignoring the single cry from Aunt Paul. He received a smart rap on the shoulder, whirled, and struck with his stick. He was rewarded with a muffled grunt. He struck again, and then again, swinging his club at those parts of his shadowy enemy which he instinctively knew were most sensitive. The main fight, however, surged around Beric and Durnick. The ring of Beric's sword and the thump of Durnick's cudgel resounded in the narrow street, along with the groans of their assailants.
"There's the boy!"
a voice rang out from behind them, and Geryon whirled. Two men were running down the street toward him, one with a sword, the other with a wicked-looking curved knife. Knowing it was hopeless, Geryon raised his club, but Silk was there. The small man launched himself from the shadows directly at the feet of the two, and all three crashed to the street in a tangle of arms and legs. Silk rolled to his feet like a cat, spun, and kicked one of the floundering men solidly just below the ear. The man sank, twitching to the cobblestones. The other scrambled away and half rose just in time to receive both of Silk's heels in his face as the rat-faced Drasnian leaped into the air, twisted and struck with both legs. Then Silk turned almost casually.
"Are you all right?"
"I'm fine. You're awfully good at this kind of thing."
"I'm an acrobat. It's simple once you know how."
"They're getting away."
Silk turned, but the two he had just put down were dragging themselves into the dark alley. There was a triumphant shout from Beric, and Geryon saw that the rest of the attackers were fleeing. At the end of the street, in the snow-speckled light from a small window, was Brill, almost dancing with fury.
"Cowards!" he shouted at his hirelings. "Cowards!"
And then Beric started for him, and he, too, turned and ran.
"Are you all right, Aunt Paul?"
Geryon said, crossing the street to where she stood.
"Of course I am. And don't do that again, young man," she snapped. "Leave street brawling to those better suited for it." "I was all right. I had my stick here." "Don't argue with me. I did not go to all the trouble of raising you to have you end up dead in a gutter."
"Is everyone all right?"
Durnick asked anxiously, coming back to them.
"Of course we are. Why don't you see if you can help
the old wolf with the horses," she snapped peevishly.
"Certainly, Mistress Paul," Durnick said mildly.
"A splendid little fight,"
Beric said, wiping his sword as he joined them.
"Not much blood, but satisfying all the same."
"I'm delighted you found it so," Aunt Paul said acidly. "I don't much care for such encounters. Did they leave anyone behind?"
"Regrettably, no, dear lady. The quarters were too narrow for good strokes, and these stones are too slippery for good footing. I marked a couple of them quite well, however. We managed to break a few bones and dent a head or two. As a group, they were much better at running than at fighting."
Silk came back from the alley where he had pursued the two who had tried to attack Geryon. His eyes were bright and his grin was vicious. "Invigorating," he said, and then laughed for no apparent reason. Wolf and Durnick had managed to calm their wild-eyed horses and lead them back to where Geryon and the others stood.
"Is anyone hurt?"
Wolf demanded.
"We are all intact,"
Beric rumbled.
"The business was hardly worth drawing a sword for."
Geryon's mind was racing. In his excitement, he spoke without stopping to consider the fact that it might be wiser to think the whole thing through first. "How did Brill know we were in Muros?" he asked. Silk looked at him sharply, his eyes narrowing.
"Perhaps he followed us from Winold."
"But we stopped and looked back. He wasn't following when we left," said Geryon. "And we've kept a watch behind us every day."
Silk frowned. "Go on, Geryon."
"I think he knew where we were going," Geryon blurted, struggling against a strange compulsion not to speak what his mind saw clearly now.
"And what else do you think?"
Wolf asked.
"Somebody told him. Somebody who knew we were coming here."
"Mingan knew," Silk said. "But Mingan's a merchant, and he wouldn't talk about his dealings to somebody like Brill."
"But Asherak the Murgo was in Mingan's counting room when Mingan hired us."
The compulsion was so strong now that Geryon's tongue felt stiff. Silk shrugged.
"Why should it concern him? Asherak didn't know who we were."
"But what if he did?" Geryon struggled. "What if he isn't just an ordinary Murgo, but one of those others? Like the one who was with those ones who passed us a couple of days after we left Darain?"
"A Grolem?"
Silk said, and his eyes widened.
"Yes. I suppose that if Asherak's a Grolem, he'd have known who we are and what we're doing."
"And what if the Grolem who passed us that day was Asherak?" Geryon fought to say it.
"What if he wasn't really looking for us, but just coming south to find Brill and send him here to wait for us?"
Silk looked very hard at Geryon.
"Very good," he said softly. "Very, very good."
He glanced at Aunt Paul.
"My compliments, Mistress Paul. You have raised a rare boy here."
"What did this Asherak look like?"
Wolf asked quickly.
"A Murgo," Silk shrugged. "He said he was from Rakoska. I took him to be an ordinary spy on some business that did not concern us. My mind seems to have gone to sleep.